There's something very peculiar about the placement and the context of the beginning of Parshas Chukas. Parshas Chukas describes Parat Duma, general laws of Tumas Ha'adam, Tumas Ha'ohel, the laws of impurity conveyed by coming into direct contact or aerial slash structural affiliation with a mace known as Tumas Ohel, other forms of contact with a mace and the relieving of that Tumah, which is much more elaborate, obviously, than relieving other forms of Tumah. It strikes us as odd in the context of the flow of Sefer Bamidbar. Sefer Bamidbar is essentially a narrative-based flow or sequence, and the halachos that are introduced are the halachos which are appropriate to the storylines, as opposed to Vayikra, which is essentially a codification of halachos with only two intervening narratives. The narrative of Nadav and Avihu in Parsha Shmini and the narrative of the blasphemer in Parsha Zemar, and each of those narratives reinforce certain themes of the halachos, of the code. But Bamidbar is a story, and when there are important halachos to be introduced, then the halachos emerge, and probably the most classic example would be Parshas Pinchas, where the laws of Nachala are in direct response to the solicitation of the Bino Selefchad, or even Parshas Baloscha, where the laws of Karban Pesach Sheni are in direct response to those people who were Tameh, the Nefesh Adam. So every halacha in Sefer Bamidbar has to have a storyline that triggers it. And the beginning of Chukas doesn't appear to have any story which triggers the halacha. And why is it placed here? So the truth is it's placed here for reasons independent of the topic I'll discuss in this medrash, but because it's a literary device to mark the passage of time, and sadly, the passage of 38 years, which was characterized by only one featured event, and that's death. People lived 38 years without any hope for long-term entry into Eretz Yisrael. Obviously, they lived meaningful lives, and lives as Avodas Hashem, and the Gemara in Shabbos derives the laws of a Kesher Shel Kayam. It's a very beautiful metaphor that there are certain knots that are forbidden on Shabbos because they're permanent, and certain knots that are lesser forbidden, they're only Drabanan because they're less permanent, they're only temporary. And the Gemara derives the level of permanence to qualify as a biblical knot based on the knots which were used to tie tents, to tie the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishkan, during their encampment in the desert for 38 years. And even though they were there only temporarily, they were there long enough to be considered, and of course, attitudinally, they saw it as kayama. So no matter how long a person lives in this life, and even if you feel that you've been, or sometimes people are medically condemned or limited in the type of horizons that they have available, every day is meaningful and every minute is meaningful, and you can breathe meaning and content into those experiences. So, but in a larger script, there was no larger agenda which was available. Eretz Yisrael was unavailable to them. Beis HaMikdash was unavailable to them. Nevuah was unavailable to them. And Jewish history is in holding pattern, waiting for that generation to pass so that the next generation can replace them. And Chazal vivified this image. Every Tisha B'Av, people would literally dig their own graves and lie down in their graves, and some would arise and some would not. And it's hard to imagine who suffered more, those who died earlier or those who have to climb out of their graves on a yearly basis, knowing that the same grave or the same hole in the ground awaited them the next year. Now, whether this is an actual event or whether it's a metaphoric event of digging your grave and expecting to pass, metaphorically, it's one and the same. It's still just as challenging and in some ways torturous. So the Torah literarily is not going to write that 38 years passed. And the literary device for demonstrating the passage of time and the death of a generation is a non sequitur, a section which doesn't naturally belong in the flow of Sefer Bamidbar, which talks about death and recovery from death. So there is a literary role for the beginning of Chukas, because, and people don't always notice this because the Torah is not overt about the timeline, Korach occurs sometime in the second year. It's a machlokas whether it occurs closer to the timeline of quote-unquote Behaloscha and the selection of the Levim, or it occurs a little bit later in that second year, post-Meraglim, so one would say around in the fall after the debacle of the Meraglim in the summer, but it occurs in the second year, whereas the events of Chukas, primarily the death of Aaron and Miriam, which we'll describe, those deaths occur 38 years later in the final year, and the rest of the Torah is about that final year upon entering Eretz Yisrael. So the Torah isn't explicit about the passage of time, but the inclusion or the insertion of this section about death and the recovery from death conveys the passage of time and, of course, the death of an earlier generation. But the Medrash has a very different view. And the Medrash describes a conversation between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Moshe, which takes place in Sefer Vayikra. Essentially, Moshe and HaKadosh Baruch Hu are studying, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is instructing Moshe about inscribing the laws of the conclusion of Shemini and of course, the laws of Tazria Mitzara, which deals, among other things, but it's pivoted upon different forms of Tumah, Tumah of animals, Tumah of human beings when their body dysfunctions or malfunctions, Tumah of human beings when their body functions properly, but there's reason that person has to be temporarily severed from entering the Mikdash and then restored through the process of Tahara. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu was effectively demonstrating to Moshe the complex or the composite of Tumah and Tahara. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu reaches Parshas Emor, and Emor is a parsha directed at the Kohanim, as all of Torah's Kohanim is, Vayikra. And Emor describes human beings and their death, not just their bodily functions. And Moshe asks Hashem, "Im nit mozev imatahe taharaso?" If man is impurified by contact with death, how does he relieve it? Lo hashivo, and Hashem doesn't answer him. Be'osa shah niskarkimu panav shel Moshe. Moshe becomes very sullen, it becomes very dispirited. Hashem doesn't give him an immediate answer for relieving tumah, which is a byproduct of contact with human death. Now it's a little bit later, of course it's 38 years later, or certainly textually a bit later, and now you've reached Parshas Chukas, Kivin Shigila Parshas Paraduma, now it's Parshas Chukas, Amalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Be'osa Shah Shemarti L'chaimor L'Kohanim, when we learned the laws of man dying, and Kohanim, when they do or they don't interact with those men, you inquired about the relieving or releasing of Tumas Adam Hames, Lo Hashavticha. I didn't answer you. I delayed you. Zutaharasel. This is the way to relieve it. V'lachula tamei me'afar streifas achatas. So Parshas Chukas is essentially the conclusion of Parshas Emor, but it's strangely clipped and pasted out of Vayikra and pasted into Sefer Bamidbar much later. Why isn't in its natural location? Why isn't Parshas Chukas included in Parshas Emor? That would be the most logical twinning, as with every other Tumah whose release is mentioned immediately after the Tumah's introduction in Sefer Vayikra. It's a fascinating conversation, but what's the master plan? What's the Kodesh Baruch Hu's authorship? What is his intention? So I think there really are two. They're slightly related, but I think there's a difference, and the differences have to be somewhat accentuated. I think number one, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu would have provided, and of course they each speak about not just contact with death, but about our view of death, because the person who's tameh by coming into contact with a dead person is a metaphor for how we view death and how we view the passage of human life. To immediately write, or to immediately include the laws of Paraduma and the relieving of Tumah based on contact with death of a human being would be to create a formulaic, simplified, quick process of recovering from death. And that would possibly cheapen or trivialize the concept of death and by extension the value of human life. It can't be that the recovery from death is just as quick and as clinical and as mechanical as recovering from giving birth or recovering from experiencing Zav or Zava or Nida or this type of Tumah or Mitzara. Death is a breakdown of human life. Death is tragic at an emotional level, but it's also metaphysically the loss of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's gift of life, the termination of that gift. And that's why we mark it with such gravitas and such solemnity. And that's to a degree why the process is so elaborate and so deeply, deeply metaphoric of Paraduma. And Moshe, so to speak, is left to ponder the magnitude of death without having a quick and simple recovery to absorb it, to process it. What does it mean for human beings to die? And that quick, rapid shifting into the release mechanism would trivialize the value of life by trivializing and devaluing the process of recovering from death. So it has to be delayed. It can't be immediate. It can't be as quick and as, one would say, interactive as some of the other parashas in Vayikra, which describe the laws of Mitzara and then the laws of recovering from Mitzara, the laws of Tumas Yoledes, when a woman gives birth, and then the laws of recovering from that Tuma. But I think there's a different reason, and I think, ironically, this can be grasped by listening to a different medrash and a story about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, one of the master teachers. He was the Rebbe of Rabbi Akiva's Rebbein. He taught Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya. He himself was a Talmud of Hillel. And very interesting personality, tremendous sweep. I talked about this in an Avostar of Nasan Shir. He knew not just Torah, but the entirety of Torah, Mishnah, Medrash, Halacha, Agados. He also was able to study the celestial workings of Maaseh Merkava. He, like Shlomo HaMelech, understood the songs of the trees, the song of nature, the way that nature spoke to one another, the communication of birds. He's a Shlomo-like figure. And because of that sweep, presumably he had a philosophical bent. And he was a go-to person for some Gentiles who were presumably sincerely engaged in questioning Jewish values, Jewish theology. So there are a lot of conversations between Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and others, and in this case, non-Jews. So the Medrash quotes one such example where, by the way, this also factors into Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's encounter with Vespasian and the salvaging of Torah and the center of Torah in Yavne by bartering Yerushalayim, which was at this point doomed to collapse to the Romans. So it's Rosh Chodesh Tammuz, so it's not too early to be thinking about issues of Churban Beis HaMikdash. So a guy enters the Beis Medrash, and he accuses the Jews of being involved in witchcraft and voodoo and black magic through the process of Haraduma, which certainly appears that way. You take an animal, you burn it, you mash its remains, you mix it with water. This is classic witchcraft. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai answers as follows. He says, have you ever seen someone who becomes possessed? Ruach tezuzis. And he says, yes, I have. And he asks this guy, he's Gentile, what do? He says, well, you bring incense and smoke-creating items, and you burn them, and you put some water, and you basically create a sacrifice, ceremony, ritual of sacrifice, and that dibbuk is evicted, and that possession is terminated. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, well, this is essentially what we're involved in, because a person has received this Ruach HaTuma, we have to remove it. And this, to a degree, satisfied the Gentile, and the Gentile walked out. And, of course, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's Talmidim questioned him and says, Rabbi, that can't be the logic of Paraduma. To which Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai responded, of course, because there is no logic, because it's the quintessential chok, it's the quintessential irrational mitzvah. And I was just offering this Gentile a concept that he could wrap his head around based on his pagan orientation. Which, in and of itself, is an interesting question about the responsibility of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai to deliver a monotheistically sound response, or a response that would just temporarily but inaccurately placate this Gentile. And of course, the question is, what was the Gentile's true intention? Not being there, it's hard to stipulate or speculate about the validity of Rabbi Yochanan's response to the Gentile. But it's clear to us that this is not accurate, but it is clear to us that presumably and cross-culturally, this is how people do respond to death. Remember, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai wasn't referring to death in his conversation with his Gentile. He's referring to possession by an external force, by an external spirit, but this is how many cultures, and certainly many of the pagan cultures of the day, and even many that historically retain pagan influences, death was dealt with through sacrifices to both atone for the dead person's limitations and failures, to facilitate passage of the dead person to the next world. From time immemorial, some of the most esoteric and magic-pivoted sacrifices and rituals surrounded a person's death. The fire, the smoke, the actual cremation of the body. Had the Paraduma experience, without knowing why the Paraduma works and how it works, because it really is a chok, but given that it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's manner for relieving death, had it been included in Sefer Vayikra, directed at the Kohanim, processed by the Kohanim exclusively, located in Parsha Zemhor, it would have been seen and would have been understood by us as a similar karban to atone for the dead person and his failures in life, to facilitate the passage. And that's clearly not how we process death, nor is it the role of Paraduma. So Paraduma has to be unnaturally severed from its quote-unquote natural location just to avoid these types of associations. And there are many halachos of Paraduma which remind us that it isn't a karban, even though it's called a chatas, and those who've studied the laws of Paraduma, especially through the lenses of Talmudic analytics, realize how valuable Paraduma is. The brisker world is very enchanted with Paraduma because it is a type of process that lies right at the seam between classic korbanos and the Torah calls it echatas, but it's not processed in the classic manner of korbanos. It's processed outside of the Beis HaMikdash. It's not exclusive to the Kohen Gadol. That's why Elazar is highlighted, and according to some opinions, it's not even exclusive to the Skan Kohen Gadol. It can even be a Kohen Hedjit. It's a Machlokas Tanoim. And even the Shechita doesn't have to be performed by any Kohen. B'shachar asal lifanav, Elazar has to watch it. Of course, probably the most glaring discrepancy between the classic Karban and Paraduma is the conference of Tumah, the fact that, or the conveyance of Tumah, that all those who are involved become Tame, which is the complete antithesis of Avod in the Beis HaMikdash, which is performed with utmost purity and has no aspect of Tumah to it, or affiliated with it. So that's what makes Paraduma so important from an analytic standpoint, because it's one of those processes, along with the Sari Lazazel, the animal sent away, discharged on Yom Kippur to the desert, which has carbon-like elements to it, but certainly isn't nestled squarely in the world of carbonos, and it allows us to carefully and methodically deconstruct carbon by analyzing or probing the aspects of carbon that it does or doesn't possess. But it's clear that there's an attempt to decarbonize Paraduma, to render it as something different. And of course, it's not a response to death, halachically. It's a response to people who come into contact with death and helping them recover and returning them or restoring them to their state of purity that allows or invites entry into the Beis HaMikdash. And it's how Judaism processes death that's important. Obviously, this is an area of life that we don't have data about or any knowledge. No one has died and returned to inform us of the details of the afterlife or the passage into the afterlife. And because of that, there will be many metaphysical or even mystical elements to it, and that's why our funeral ceremonies are, to a degree, dominated by non-rational activities and minhagim that are delivered through generations about how to best facilitate this passage. But by inserting a karban, it would tilt the scales, not just towards mysticism, but towards sacrifice and ritual. And it would provide two things. First of all, it would suggest that there's a certain sin to death, rather than viewing death as a natural process of life, and every man passes. It's the only certainty in our life, and people who die don't die based on their sins. They die based on the termination of their life. Some people do die based on their sins. Some people don't. Of course, we, beyond our ability to render those judgments and to connect those dots, and sometimes reward and punishment is deferred for a different reality in a different world. And not just in how we view the relationship between death and sin, but just the relationship or the role of death. It would be seen as something almost beyond life rather than part of life, and something which we embrace as a pivot of life, as something which helps us focus on the mortality of human experience, and hopefully that recognition lends urgency and lends drive and many other moral traits. It's so sad to read the first couple sections of Bereishis and read people who lived 800 years and 900 years and 700 years. And when I was young, I was certainly very jealous of these people, but you sense a moral malaise. And part of the moral malaise is there's no focal point. There's no urgency. They're living forever and they don't accomplish much. They is just slip into listlessness, and listlessness and lethargy becomes addictive and contagious. So the sense that we respond to death through korbanos would imply, A, that there's a sin that has to be atoned for, and it would take death out of the realm of, I wouldn't say rational, I think death is rational, but out of the realm of human existence and render it as something esoteric and something magical and something, and it would disconnect death from life. And I think that the Torah is militating against this. So it displaces or supplants the discussion of recovery from death from Sefer Vayikra to Sefer Bamidbar, and it creates a process which is a chok, but is very clearly a negation of many of the laws of Korbanos, and just lifting it from the Parsha of Korbanos and the Parsha of Kohanim, Emor al Kohanim b'nei Aaron, which would have been its natural location, and reinserting it somewhere else, ironically, as Aaron himself is about to die. And because he dies, obviously the office of Kohuna doesn't play as pivotal a role. And also death is seen as something which even great people experience, and it's not limited to, and this is what I spoke about a few minutes ago, it's not based on human failure or human malfunction. There are many important reasons that the recovery from death can't be inserted or can't flow in its natural location.